Okay, so I think today's talk will be relatively short and hopefully to the point. So let's see how it goes. But just to recap on the ground we've covered in the last couple of mornings. So I've talked about enlightenment, it being an ineffable mystery, ourselves having the potential for enlightenment, and the Buddha being a mediator for us, or a transcendental object, a transcendental person for us, somebody that we can connect with from where we are now, that leads us beyond our current level of understanding about reality. And I've said that the Buddha alone is not enough for us. That's not the Buddha's failing, that's our inability to see him clearly. The Buddha's not necessarily enough for us as a transcendental object. So the refuge tree is an elaboration. The refuge tree is the Buddha, but an elaboration of the Buddha's qualities, if you like. It gives us more of a picture of enlightenment, shows us that we have a connection with it in the midst of our mundane, unenlightened existence. We have a connection through its manifestations, its outpourings in time and space, and through the qualities that we see on our own level that are embodied in the archetypal figures. But as I said yesterday, in making that more clear to us, it doesn't betray the truth it's trying to communicate to us. So in making it more clear, the image still communicates to us a sense of the mystery of enlightenment. Communicates something timeless, something outside all of our categories of understanding, communicates something ineffable. And to use a formula that we're all familiar with, it's communicating that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. The refuge tree is an image of that. The Buddha is an embodiment of that. So in my group this morning, we talked a lot about positive confusion and being in a state of positive confusion. So again, that's the attitude we need to cultivate when we're talking about these kinds of things. And I think looked at like this, if we look at the refuge tree as the Buddha and the Buddha as the refuge tree, and them representing that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. The refuge tree really does start to become a thing of beauty. It's worthy of reverence. The fact that we have an image that embodies that kind of truth, that's incredible. The fact that iconography has developed to the point where it can display that to us is amazing. It's like a great feat of human endeavour that such an image can be produced. It must be touched by something transcendental. The problem is, and it's a problem I have, I can look at the image and, to coin a phrase, I can still do an upaka. So you remember, upaka was the ascetic that the Buddha met after leaving Bodh Gaya, who didn't see the Buddha. So we can see the refuge tree, in a sense, we can look at an image of it, but then we can say, oh, well, that's nice, and go off and do something else, go off and forget all about it. So even the refuge tree, even with its further elaboration, its refinement, its further attempt to communicate as the truth that the Buddha embodies, even the refuge tree as an image is not enough for us. So why is that? Why doesn't just looking at the refuge tree catapult us into full and perfect enlightenment? So we don't find fulfillment by connecting with the image of the refuge tree because we're still looking somewhere else. So we still think that fulfillment lies somewhere else other than in the image of the refuge tree. And it's not even that we just think that, we feel that. We're powerfully driven, powerfully moved to seek fulfillment somewhere other than in the refuge tree. So remember, the Buddha in the Arya Parayasana Sutta was quite clear about this, wasn't he? He said, bhikkhus, there are these two types of search. There's the ignoble search and there's the noble search. And the ignoble search, you'll remember, was when somebody that is subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement seeks fulfillment in that which is also subject to birth, old age, sickness, death, etc. Doesn't see the danger in pursuing that search. So the refuge tree doesn't interest us enough because we're looking for satisfaction in that which is subject to birth, old age, sickness and death, and the refuge tree is not that. It's not a representation of that nature. And this is hardwired in us, it goes really deep. We don't have to beat ourselves up about that. In a sense, it's our inheritance, it's part of our human nature. Whether we look at that from an evolutionary point of view or a karmic point of view, that's the way we see things, that's the way we've come into the world, is to seek fulfillment in the conditioned. But we're also on the noble quest, the Arya Parayasana, at the same time. So we've all embarked on that to some extent. And we all have faith, we've all released our faith to some extent. And as I said previously, that's not weak. It's powerful enough to have moved us, it's powerful enough to have moved us to ask for ordination, to have got us to come on this retreat. But that shift from one type of search to the other type of search, it isn't complete. It hasn't completed itself. So we're in touch enough with the noble quest to have found the refuge tree, to even know that it exists in the world. But we're not in touch with it enough that it stops us pursuing the ignoble quest. So Bhante has talked about this in terms of the gravitational pull. So there's the gravitational pull of the conditioned and the gravitational pull of the unconditioned. And until stream entry, until irreversibility, we'll always be at the mercy of the pull of the conditioned. But I quite like this language of Arya Parayasana. So the word asana often is translated as seeking. That's why we get search or quest. The literal translation of asana is seeking. But it can also mean longing. So we can have an ignoble longing and a noble longing. So longing or desire. Can have noble desire or ignoble desire. So I think that brings something else out. It's like we have this conflicting desire within us. It's not just a conflicting idea about what fulfillment is. It's conflicting desire. It's a strong force. We've got desire for that which is conditioned. We've got desire for that which is unconditioned. And another way of speaking about it would be in terms of going for refuge. And in a way, I think this is probably the most appropriate way of talking about it. It's our common language, going for refuge. And Bhante's key insight, of course, that going for refuge is the unifying principle. It's what makes one a Buddhist. So we can think of human life in terms of a search for refuge. You know, if we want to talk about what the human existential situation is, we can look at it in terms of being a search for refuge. It's not Buddhism, it's not just Buddhist, that's human. It's the truth about humankind, is that we're born into an insecure world where nothing offers security seemingly. So we look for security. That's human nature, to seek security. And as the Buddha said, there are two options really. We can either seek security in the conditioned, we can go for refuge to things that are conditioned, or we can seek security in the unconditioned. We can go for refuge to something that is unconditioned. So this is made quite explicit in the Dhammapada, in the chapter on the enlightened one. So we get these verses. Many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees, and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. He who goes for refuge to the enlightened one, to the truth, and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the four Aryan truths, namely suffering, the origin of suffering, the passing beyond suffering, and the Aryan Eightfold Way leading to the pacification of suffering, for him this is a safe refuge. For him this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So we can hear those verses and think, oh, we don't do that. We don't go for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees, and shrines. That's what they did back then, because they were stupid and believed in all kinds of gods and ghosts and fairies. But we've got our modern equivalents, haven't we? The places that we go for refuge to, of that nature. You could even look at it in terms of gods and deities. So what are the other gods and deities that we worship in our own time? I've never read the book, but some of you might have read American Gods by Neil Gaiman. And he talks in that novel about how the old gods have been forgotten, but there are new gods. Things like the god of the internet, for example. I don't know, I'm making it up now. I don't know if this is in the book, but the god of money, the god of mobile phones, etc., etc. So what are the things that we worship? You know, put it in those terms. What are the things we desire and worship and revere that actually keep us bound to suffering? So yeah, we can use the language of going for refuge in the same way as the language of the noble quest. And there are two choices. We go for refuge to something that can liberate us or to something that will keep us struggling and suffering. So the image then of the refuge tree alone is not enough to bring about that decisive shift in our direction. That decisive shift in our search, in our channeling of desire, in our going for refuge. There's such a strong force, the gravitational pull is strong, that just seeing an image of the refuge tree is not enough, despite having talked about what that image is trying to communicate to us. So for the refuge tree to have its maximum effect, we need to see the refuge tree in its proper context. So that image comes to us, it comes out of a practice. It comes out of the going for refuge and prostration practice. So it's not just an image at all. For it to have an effect on us, we have to experience it. We have to enter into a whole drama we might say, in which the refuge tree is part and in which we are part. So that whole drama, that we could call it the drama of cosmic enlightenment, it starts with the dissolving of all those habitual desires, the dissolving of all our views that get in the way, the dissolving of all our habits, the dissolving of all dualities, and a stepping into that open dimension of being, symbolized by blue sky. And the refuge tree emerges within that context. So we're part of this so-called image. When we did the practice yesterday, it's not that it's abstract and apart from us. There's no frame that separates the image from us. We're in it. And being part of that image, if you like, being part of that vision, what we do within that context is we go for refuge with our body, with our speech, with our mind. The whole of us goes for refuge to the true refuge, to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha, as represented in that image. And like Sarita said yesterday, even if we drift in and out, even if our speech goes, even if our mind goes, something of us is still pursuing that noble quest. Something of us is still going for refuge to a true refuge. Probably our body is still moving. And obviously it's not just us, so everybody else, all other beings are in that so-called image too, the part of that drama. And they're all going for refuge to a true refuge as well. And what we're all going for refuge to is an image of going for refuge itself. It's an image of going for refuge at the highest possible level. So Bhante's talked in terms of levels of going for refuge. So just briefly, cultural, provisional, effective, real, ultimate. You can look them up if you're interested in definitions of those. But all those levels are represented there in that drama. So there's cultural, there's provisional, there's effective, going for refuge, moving towards the refuge tree. But on the refuge tree itself, we've got an image of real, going for refuge in terms of the Arya Sangha, and ultimate going for refuge, Buddhahood, is imaged there. So what we're doing is we're stepping into a vision that is a vision of going for refuge. We're reimagining the whole cosmos in terms of going for refuge. So Bhante speaks of this as a possible sixth level, in inverted commas, of going for refuge. The whole cosmos is going for refuge. And here's the thing, that's more real. That's a more real way of actually seeing life. Seeing life in terms of going for refuge is more real than our habitual way of seeing life. So Bhante says in The History of My Going for Refuge, he's quoting some of his older lectures. He talks about this cosmic going for refuge. And he says, each form of life aspires to develop into a higher form. This might not be an exact quotation, I'm afraid, but each form of life aspires to develop into a higher form. It, in inverted commas, goes for refuge to that higher form. And this is a direct quotation. It might sound impossibly poetic, but it is what one in fact sees. So it might sound impossibly poetic to say that the whole of the cosmos is, in inverted commas, going for refuge, trying to aspire to a higher form. But when we look at things, that's what's happening. That's what's going on. And Bhante describes this vision, this cosmic going for refuge, as the key to the mystery of existence. This is the key to the mystery of existence. That the whole cosmos is going for refuge, to use a particular way of talking about it. So in the going for refuge and prostration practice, we've left behind a deluded view that there are all different kinds of options in life. Actually, there's just the search for refuge. And within that, we've got two choices. We can go for refuge to the Buddha, we can go for refuge to something that liberates, or we can go for refuge to things that imprison. And in the practice, we're essentializing things. We're seeing life in terms of going for refuge. We're adopting that perspective of the Buddha, that there's either this or there's that. There's two kinds of search. There's two kinds of going for refuge. And we enact the noble quest rather than the ignoble quest. We enact the going for refuge to a true refuge rather than to a false refuge. And we're wishing that for everybody else as well. We're visualizing everybody else making that choice too. So that brings out the whole altruistic dimension of going for refuge. So going for refuge, the more deeply we do that, we see that it's not just about ourselves, it's also about everybody else. So an altruistic dimension arises. And we're making that conscious in the practice. So don't be over literal about that. It's not that we're trying to evangelize and forcibly convert everybody to Buddhism when we're doing the going for refuge and prostration practice. But if we're going for refuge, we naturally want everyone else to go for refuge as well. We want everyone else to find fulfillment. We want everyone else to pursue the noble quest. We want everybody else to transcend selfishness. And we can call that going for refuge. For us, that's expressed as going for refuge to the three jewels. So of course, as we enact this drama, every time we do the going for refuge and prostration practice, we enact that drama. We enter into that way of seeing the universe, we make that choice, we aspire that others make that choice. All of that has an effect on us. All of that modifies us, it modifies our consciousness. It creates a volition. It creates a volition that moves us away from the gravitational pull of the conditioned and into the orbit of the unconditioned. It's creating a volition to go for refuge to the best of refuges. That's what the practice is about. So often we think that the practice is about prostrating. So we even refer to it as the prostration practice. But actually it's the going for refuge and prostration practice. It's a going for refuge practice. We're practicing going for refuge. We're training ourselves in what it means to go for refuge. We're creating that strong volition to go for refuge. And this creating of volition, of positive momentum, it's really highly prized in the Buddhist tradition. So in the Dhammapada again, the chapter on the spiritually immature, we get the verse, irrigators draw off water, fletchers straighten arrows, carpenters shape wood, the spiritually mature discipline themselves. So the spiritually mature discipline themselves. The spiritually mature create positive volitions, train themselves. And if going for refuge is the most fundamental thing in a Buddhist life, then the most fundamental training, the most fundamental volition that we have to create for ourselves is to go for refuge. So when we're doing the prostration practice, it doesn't matter what we feel about it, or when we're reflecting about the practice, it doesn't really matter what we feel about it, whether we like it or we dislike it. On one level, that doesn't matter. What matters is that we do it. What matters is that we actually do the practice and we create that strong volition to go for refuge to the Buddha. This is how we make effective going for refuge. It's how we make our going for refuge effective. It's what going for refuge effectively means, that we'll always do it, no matter what the particular content of our experience is. We'll respond to our experience by going for refuge. We know what we need to do in order to carry on going for refuge. Even if we don't like things, we get frustrated. Even if things are going really well and we're getting excited, well, we know what we need to do to carry on deepening our going for refuge. So here's a quote from Aloka. I've got a few quotes from Aloka here because I think he's really good on this area. So this is in What is Myth, page 58. It's important that we don't get bogged down in superficialities, such as whether or not we like the refuge tree, or approve of the selection and arrangement of its occupants, or even whether we like or enjoy or find useful the prostration practice. All this is swept aside by the underlying awe-inspiring vision of life as the unavoidable creative necessity to transcend all limitations and the disastrous consequences of obstructing that. So all of those superficialities are swept aside by the underlying awe-inspiring vision of life as the unavoidable creative necessity to transcend all limitations. That's what really matters. That's what the going for refuge and prostration practice is about. It's about developing this awe-inspiring vision, seeing that for ourselves and all beings, there's an unavoidable creative necessity to transcend all our limitations. And we can't carry on obstructing that. So imagine the effect of doing that as a repeated practice. Going into that essentialized way of seeing the universe. Going into that vision with all beings, creating that strong volition. Then coming back out into our everyday life. And then going back in and doing that, stepping out again into our ordinary life, in inverted commas. Eventually that vision, that way of seeing things that we experience in the context of the going for refuge and prostration practice will start to influence how we see things otherwise. So it would start affecting us, it would start affecting what we do, start affecting how we relate to other people. This is a really obvious point, I know, but that's true of all Dharma practice. The practices are trying to have an effect on us, modify us in such a way that it then means we behave differently. So another quote from Aloka, What is Myth, page 58. We're aiming eventually at seeing everything in terms of going for refuge. Not as some naive utopian fantasy, but a fundamental shift in one's perceptions, which ensures the ability to keep things in perspective and work against the continual tendency to reinforce self-interest, which is ever present this side of stream entry. So we're working at seeing everything in terms of going for refuge, bringing about a fundamental shift that works against that tendency to reinforce self-interest. And then he says on page 59, all negative mental states arise from loss of perspective, a narrowing down to contractive, detached, isolated self-interest. If we can keep an awareness of the widest possible context, then even the inevitable difficulties can be responded to positively and creatively. We may not be particularly happy about them, but that doesn't mean we have to slide into passive negativity. It all depends on awareness of context and purpose. So the context is the cosmic going for refuge, life as an existential search for refuge. The purpose is developing an awareness of that and making that shift from the false to the true refuges for the benefit of ourselves and others. So it really is as simple as that. The Buddha had it right. That's quite a profound insight, I think, of the Buddha's at the beginning of the Aryaparyasana Sutta, when he says there are two kinds of search. It's this or it's that. It's the noble search or the ignoble search. It's a true refuge or a false refuge. So I hope I've communicated something of why the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice helps us to see that simplicity, helps us to see it's, in a sense, as simple as that. This practice cuts away everything that obscures that simplicity. It trains us in the essentialized way of seeing things. It trains us in that way of seeing and that way of acting. And it does that in such a way that it affects our whole life, not just our meditation, but our whole life. So I can say all that, you can hear all that, we can know all that, we can agree, and yet, what do we do? So we could do the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice every morning, couldn't we? We could do this liberating practice every morning. We could just get up an hour earlier than we normally would. And with that extra hour, we could cultivate an awe-inspiring vision, grounded in insight, that would bring about a fundamental shift in our perception for the benefit of all life everywhere. We could do that. That's an option. That's an option for all of us. But what do we do? And what do I do? Turn off the alarm, roll over, and go back to sleep. Have an extra hour in bed. So I said before, the image is not enough for us. Just seeing a picture of the refuge tree is not enough to catapult us into full and perfect enlightenment. Seeing the image of the context, in the context of the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice, drawing out its significance, seeing how effective and a practice that is, how much of an effect it can have on our mind, even that's not enough. I still want the extra hour in bed. So we're getting down to the fundamental thing now, isn't it? Which is, we have to want to do it. It's not enough just to have the image. It's not enough just to have the practice with the image in it. It's not enough to understand the significance of that, the liberating power of that. Fundamentally, it comes down to our motivation. We have to want to do it. We have to want to use that practice make that practice effective for us. Again, another quote from the Dhammapada: by you must the zealous effort be made. The Buddhas only point the way. The refuge tree only points the way. The going for refuge and prostration practice only points the way. By you must the zealous effort be made. But it is helpful to articulate the significance, I think, of the practice and of the image. So I hope that's helped. Maybe that does, in doing that, that does move us to some extent. But as I said, we've got to turn ourselves about in the deepest seat of our consciousness. We've got to turn about our deepest desires. We've got to learn to love it. We've got to learn to love the refuge tree. We've got to learn to love the going for refuge and prostration practice. We've got to learn to love it so much that to not be able to express our love for it would be a disaster to us. It would be stifling to us not be able to express that love.